Once there were four children whose names were Peter, Susan, Edmund, and Lucy. This is a story about something that happened to them while they were sent away from London during the war because of the air raids. They were sent to the house of an old professor who lived in the heart of the country, 10 miles from the nearest railway station and 2 miles from the nearest post office. That is the opening of C.S. Lewis's fairy tale classic, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, first published in 1950. And if you were at all familiar with the story, you remember clearly that the children are delighted to find themselves in such a large house with so many rooms and passageways to explore. The day after their arrival, it is pouring down rain, and the children are forced to stay indoors. But as they explore the professor's old house, they discover an empty room, empty except for a large wardrobe. Lucy, the youngest, decides to explore the wardrobe and checks to see if it is unlocked. To her surprise, it's open and 2 mothballs fall out. It is through the wardrobe that Lucy is stunned to find a whole other world, the land of Narnia. And soon, the adventure begins. Just a curious side note to the thumbnail graphic of our episode this week, there just so happened to be a beautiful wardrobe in an empty room adjacent to where Justin and I recorded our interview. I had Justin jump in and explore it. Narnia has had a lasting impact on countless numbers of children and adults over the decades since its publication in 1950, leading many to better appreciate their faith in Christ and leading others to the Christian faith for the first time. Narnia is a wonderful, heartwarming tale of adventure, sin, forgiveness, and grace. Narnia also serves to remind us of the importance of storytelling. We flock to movies, films, television shows, and books that provide for us beauty, awe, goodness, evil, sin, sorrow, and ultimately redemption. Stories give us a hope and remind us that we are ourselves part of an unfolding story. Lewis argued that Christianity is the true myth, not that it is just a good story, but that it is the true story of which all other good stories, myths, and legends only capture in part. How then does traditional Christianity encompass the story of the cosmos as told by many secular and non-Christian thinkers today? Has the science of the universe once and for all done away with Christianity? Atheist cosmologist Lawrence Krauss in 2012 believed that not only did our universe have a beginning, but that the universe actually came out of nothing. Even Richard Dawkins accepted this conclusion, as he wrote in the afterword of Krauss's 2012 book, A Universe from Nothing, quote, "Not only does the physics tell us how something could have come from nothing, it goes further, by Krauss's account, and shows us that nothing is unstable. Something was almost bound to spring into existence from it," end quote. While Dawkins and Krauss believe that God had nothing to do with the universe, and that the physics of the cosmos eliminate God as an explanation for why there is something rather than nothing, they do at least affirm 2 ancient principles of traditional Christian theology. The universe had a beginning, and that the universe came into being ex nihilo, that is, out of nothing. While those like Dawkins and Krauss dismiss any possibility of the miraculous, a universe such as ours popping into existence from nothing at all is even more miraculous than God calling the universe into existence. If nothing is so powerful as to produce universes, why doesn't this nothingness cause more common everyday things like coffee, cell phones, or cats to pop into existence? Because out of nothing, nothing comes, as the saying goes. Since 2012, many scientists, philosophers, and critics have taken Krauss to task for his equivocating about what exactly he meant by nothing. What is clear is that there would be no science of the universe at all. No physics, no cosmology, no astronomy, or astrophysics. Were not the universe intelligible to begin with? Why do our conscience, the universe, our sense of beauty and awe, and mathematics all fit together so wondrously? King David's declaration in the 19th Psalm gives us the most concise reason why. The heavens are telling of the glory of God, and the expanse declares the works of his hands. Day to day pours forth speech, and night unto night reveals knowledge. As David contemplated the heavens in the 8th Psalm, he also marveled at God's care for him. When I consider thy heavens, the works of thy fingers, the moon and the stars which thou hast ordained, what is man that thou art mindful of him, and the son of man that thou dost care for him? The story of the cosmos, as told by modern cosmology, is a tale of impersonal forces, sound and fury that signifies literally nothing. For all its knowledge of what the universe is made of, science has not yet even begun to address what the universe actually is or what it all means. There is no happily ever after in the modern cosmologist's nightmare, no rhyme or reason for our existence, no specialness, no purpose or meaning, or significance for our lives. The universe is just an illusion, and so are we. God doesn't exist. Everything came from nothing and will eventually return to nothing. Religious faith is only a fairy tale. But that is not the Christian story. As the character of Puddleglum told the witch in C.S. Lewis's Silver Chair, quote, "Suppose we have only dreamed or made up all those things, trees and grass and sun and moon and stars and Aslan himself. Suppose we have. Then all I can say is that, in that case, the made-up things seem a good deal more important than the real ones. Suppose this black pit of a kingdom of yours is the only world. Well, it strikes me as a pretty poor one. And that's a funny thing, when you come to think of it. We're just babies making up a game, if you're right. But four babies playing a game can make a play world which licks your real world hollow. That's why I'm going to stand by the play world. I'm on Aslan's side, even if there isn't any Aslan to lead it. I'm going to live as like a Narnian as I can, even if there isn't any Narnia. We're leaving your court at once and setting out in the dark to spend our lives looking for the overland." End quote. And in our world, the principalities and powers in heavenly places have persuaded a multitude that there is no heaven, no hell, no God, and no purpose for our existence. But again, this is not the end of the story. Nor is it the true story of the cosmos. For the wardrobe of the Christian faith invites us further up and further in. Where we encounter closed doors and dead ends are just the places where the Christian adventure begins, where Jesus calls each of us by our own name, where he takes us by our hand to lead us into a story we could never have dreamt of. Lazarus, you'll recall, was quite shut up in his wardrobe, beyond all earthly hope. Yet Jesus called to him, "Lazarus, come forth." There are no words of Lazarus recorded in the pages of Scripture, and we can only imagine what it must have been like for him to see the light of day and his family again. So if you're facing an impossible situation at the present, be alert for God's voice. You are not yet at the end of your story. Thank you. Lazarus' resurrection is a foretaste of what Jesus would also do for us. He burst the doors of death. The Romans believed they had fully secured the wardrobe that contained Jesus' lifeless body. To their shock and dismay, however, the stone had been rolled away and Jesus was no longer in the tomb. Through his death on the cross and resurrection 3 Jewish days later, we have been forgiven of our sin and have had Jesus' perfect righteousness credited to us. We are justified by faith in Christ, not by our works, but by what Jesus did for us in living a perfectly obedient life, dying a sinner's death on the cross, and resurrecting to the newness of eternal and everlasting life. Science speaks of the universe as emanating from impersonal forces coming into existence from nothing. But the Christian story tells a different tale. The universe coming into being was a personal act of divine love, for God is love. The Godhead's communicant three-in-one Father, Son, and Holy Spirit brought forth the universe in love. The cosmos reflects the glory of God, His love, His power, His wisdom, and His righteousness, pointing us toward the ultimate manifestation of God's love toward us in Christ Jesus. So come and jump in the wardrobe with our guest again this week, apologist, author, speaker, and broadcaster Justin Brierley, as we continue to discuss his latest book, The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God, Why New Atheism Grew Old, and Secular Thinkers Are Considering Christianity Again. We talk a bit about why modern cosmology seems to be affirming God's existence, and the importance of narratives and storytelling for our time. So come along with Justin and I as we go further up and further in. As we begin part two, I asked Justin what good he thought might have come out of the new atheist movement. Here again is Justin Brierley.
Well, I think every generation sort of needs to rediscover its intellectual metal.
Yeah.
And I think sort of kind of through the 60s and the countercultural revolution and the advance of postmodernity, I think that the church had unwittingly perhaps, but kind of entered into a kind of a period of basically a kind of more emotional, sentimental
right.
kind of way of
engaging faith. The What Would Jesus Do movement of the 19th century was like that.
Arguably, you know, the sort of, you know, it became more about an experience and so on. And I think what the new atheists did, they came along and they gave us a good shake-up and said, well, is this all just feeling and emotion? Or is there any actual truth, you know, to back this up? And suddenly we had to put down our guitars and tambourines and pick up some of our Augustine and apologetics and theology
right.
to sort of, yeah, because they forced us to kind of think, okay, yeah, well how do we respond to this, you know, all this new atheist sort of stuff saying there's no evidence for God and so on. I can't just say, well, I had this wonderful experience in church the other day. And so I think that's why I do thank the new atheists. They did sort of help to remind us of our intellectual heritage
right.
as Christians
right.
and step back into it a bit.
Right. Well, I'm going to do something a little different here. I just recently wrote a blog where my blog is my attempts to try out writing like C.S. Lewis. I know nobody's going to be able to do that, but I love what I admire most about C.S. Lewis and what Michael has taught me about Lewis is the way he could integrate things, Justin. The way he could take the disparate parts. And this was Tolkien's complaint of Lewis's Narnia Chronicles. It's a mishmash.
Yes.
It's a hodgepodge. It won't do.
Mm.
You know, but it's funny because if Michael Ward's thesis is true about planet Narnia and the heavens being behind Narnia, he even in the midst of criticism from his best friend, Lewis didn't tell anybody what he was doing.
Yeah.
But for Tolkien, it was a mishmash, a hodgepodge. But for Lewis, and as I was reading his 16th century history of the English language, his genius was, his desire was to emulate the people that he admired from the 16th century, and they were able to combine disparate parts of the cultures and the times and the epochs in which they lived, and this super impressed Lewis. Like, if like George MacDonald, thinking at an interdisciplinary level, from science, philosophy, yeah. and theology, how does that all fit together? Mm. I bet I could do the same thing. I could weave this together in the story about Narnia. So I have this quote. I wrote this article where I combined, you mentioned in your book, and I thought we could kind of go into the cosmological aspect of this, talk a little bit about the argument and why science isn't disproving Christianity. I combined a Stephen Hawking quote with a Jane Austen quote to sort of make the point, it was kind of a fun thing, but we sort of make the serious point of what Dante was getting at, that it's love that moves the sun and other stars. There's a underlying narrative of love, God's love, that defines who we are, that we are part of who, we belong to him, and God is love and God is truth. But I wanted to read this to you and get your feedback, because I think it's something I heard a lot on Unbelievable, and I think you've heard it too. But you know the Austinian quote, I think it opens with Pride and Prejudice. It's a truth universally acknowledged.
Yes.
Is that Pride and Prejudice?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So I modified it a little bit to fit modern cosmology.
Go
I said,
on.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that a physicist in possession of a good equation must be in want of an explanation.
I like it. That's a good one.
So, but I say all that to say that the narrative of what does the cosmos mean is being told to us through stories. We went back all the way up to Carl Sagan, who so eloquently enraptured everybody's imagination, which the way he told stories about the cosmos. I was able to interview his daughter a couple of years ago, Sasha. But Sagan was a masterful storyteller.
Yes.
And people and atheists who like him almost consider him like a pastor or a pope. If there's any kind of spirituality in the lives of an unbeliever, it comes out of Carl Sagan's cosmos.
Yeah.
But my point is that, Justin, is that as you've heard the stories about what makes the universe tick, what breathes fire into the equation and gives it a universe, you know, the Stephen Hawking quote that you have in your book, and you've had a ton of cosmologists and scientists and philosophers talking about the universe. To tell the story of the cosmos, we've kind of ended up back at Genesis. To quote Robert Jastrow, it looks like a band of theologians have been sitting here for centuries.
Yes.
As we climb the final mountain of looking for our equations, we're greeted by a band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries. It seems like science has come back to this theological idea.
That's often what I feel like. It's I think, you know, the conceit of the New Atheist was that the more we know about science and the universe, the less reason we have to believe in God. But I think there has been this trajectory in the opposite direction, actually. The problem is, the more you know about the universe, the more complex you understand it to become, the more, I think, you start to, it just continues to cry out for an explanation. There's a sort of, it's almost like the universe can't explain itself. It's almost like science can't do the job of explaining the universe, because it's like, science is the tool you're using. It's like a microscope, you know, but the microscope can't be turned on itself. It's sort of, well, why does that work so well? Why does science work so well? It's like you always bump into these kind of questions that are kind of next level. They take to the next level of metaphysics. And I've had some really interesting conversations with people, again, who are not conventionally religious in physics, people like Paul Davies, you know, but who are asking really interesting questions and just don't accept the kind of new atheist materialist narrative. They're saying something's going on. And so when I have Paul Davies on and he talks about this idea of why is there this directionality in the universe? Why do we go from essentially nothing to something to matter, to from matter to life, from life to consciousness, from consciousness to sort of intelligent life.
That whole narrative.
Yeah, that understands itself. And as he sees it, to sort of comprehension, you know, the fact that we can then comprehend ourselves in the universe.
Right.
And he says there's this directionality. And he says either this is like some massive fluke or there's some principle at work in the universe behind it. And he said, you know, I don't think of myself as religious, but this is probably the closest I get to a religious feeling about the universe. And he said it's what Einstein called, you know, a kind of cosmic religious feeling.
Well, it reminds me of that episode you did with Bill Craig and Roger Penrose. I wrote that
very
article
much,
on it. Thank you for letting me write that article about that. But my question in the article, and I think to a lot of people that were watching, when I think it was either you or Bill asked Roger what was stopping him from believing in God. What did Roger do? Do you remember?
Well,
I don't want to put you on the spot.
As I remember it, he basically outlined, you know, in many ways that his concern was that it was too sort of parochial an answer. He conceived of it being sort of like, I think he just doesn't like the idea of a sort of personal God.
Yeah, but he pulled back to, at some point after that question was posed to him, he started quoting from a story.
Yeah.
And he says, well, I don't know if this is it or not, you know. But he couched it in terms of whatever it is, it might be like this story.
Right.
Yeah. And I think he believes in the efficacy of numbers, like in some Platonic realm or something. But this when you talk to these super brilliant people who gaze on the cosmos in the most intense, wondrous and fantastic detail, and they're like Paul Davies, and their heads are spinning, like there must be something behind this. Justin, what do you think is stopping these brilliant minds from embracing the God of the universe?
I think they've probably all got different reasons depending on their personal history and psychology. A lot of the time, I think they have a picture of religion, which, you know, perhaps understandably has been handed down to them by their culture and so on, where they just see it as inadequate or superstitious or whatever, and they think that's... When we talk about God or Christianity, they're being invited to kind of regress into something that's childlike and you know, has memories of some Sunday school that they attended once. And I think that's the problem, is that they've never actually encountered full-bodied Christianity.
So they have the stained glass Sunday school association that Lewis wanted to get rid of, and get that, whatever that blockage was from personal experience, Lewis wanted to remove.
Exactly. Or they've you know, had their sort of view of religion tainted by too many, you know, interactions with young earth creationists or whatever that kind of put them off the whole thing and made them think, well, this is just what religious people do. But they've often nevertheless, you know, even in that conversation with Penrose, they're not satisfied with the materialist atheist account of reality.
No, that seems to be a common theme. Yeah. Like, I don't know, I'm not going to say it's God, but I'm not satisfied with
at the center of that conversation between Craig and Penrose was the fact that, well, Penrose clearly, very quickly it came apparent, he's not a naturalist, because he actually believes there are three different realms. He believes that there is the natural realm, you know, of planets and, you know, stuff, but there's this realm of consciousness, and then there's this abstract realm of mathematics. He believes there's these three separate realms, and that what baffles him is that they so perfectly map onto each other.
Yeah.
There's no particular reason on the surface of it why we should be able to map a physical universe in the laws of mathematics using our conscious mind. And yet we do, and we do extraordinary things because of it. And this kind of just, as he said to Craig, he doesn't know why this works. And Craig, you know, bless him, sort of said, well, maybe it's because there is a God. Maybe... You know, you can unify those three realms in the kind of conscious realm that there's a divine.
Well, Alexander, did you ever have? Sorry for interrupting. My thoughts pop into my head like rabbits on a golf course. I just chase them. Did you ever have Alexander Milenkin on your show?
No, I never did. But he's
another one that reminds me something of Paul Davies, where he's definitely not got that anti-theistic edge. I know Bill Craig has corresponded with him about the Bord-Guth-Vilenkin theorem that Bill has often quoted in debates and discussions. But Vilenkin says something that had stuck with me, and this is in his book, Many Worlds in One, I think is the name of the book, where he says, upon what were the laws of physics written?
Yeah.
And he uses the term before the universe. Of course, it depends on who you talk to that may ridicule you for saying before. But he said, if the laws are mathematical in nature and they precede the origin of the physical universe, upon what were these laws written? And then he concedes, he says, if mind is the medium of mathematics, does that mean that mind predates the universe? Now, he stops short of embracing theism Davies and Penrose, but all of these brilliant cosmologists come right up to the edge.
They
all seem to see at least the feet of the theologians that are on the apex of the mountain that everybody's been climbing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, going back to Paul Davies, when he sort of described this sort of directionality of the universe from, you know, inert matter to self-reflective life that and the comprehensibility of the universe to us, you know. I mean, I just thought, well, to all intents and purposes, you're describing the Logos, you know, this idea of, that is right there in John's Gospel, of a kind of creative organizing principle that speaks life and order into the chaos.
Right.
It's like you've just described in scientific language what John describes in theological language.
Mm.
And I just think there is this extraordinary resonance and consonance between the best science and where it takes us and the way that scriptures describe this force of life-giving logic and creativity.
Mm.
And I just think that's an exciting thing. And I wish I could get Paul Davies to sort of make the leap. I don't know what it would take for him. I think I asked him the last conversation I had, I kind of, you know, tried to
he's
kind of,
such a wonderful, warm-hearted guy, too. You know, he's very likable. But it's interesting. I've been fascinated with the Apollo space program forever. Mm. My dad knew somebody at NASA, and so he had all this Apollo paraphernalia in the house, and I was growing up with all this stuff around my house growing up. And I was able to interview last summer. I was able to interview Charlie Duke, who was the 10th man to walk on the surface of the moon.
Wow.
We had a fascinating conversation. We read scripture together. It was awesome. He was such a nice guy. I was like talking to my grandfather. You know, he was such a great guy. But in the Apollo program, you have two historic flights. You have Apollo 8 in December of 1968. They were kind of, it was supposed to be a low Earth orbit mission, but they went to the moon on information that they got from the Russians that the Russians might be putting men in orbit around there. So let's go to the moon. So they did, and the crew didn't tell anybody what they were going to read. But when they saw the Earth on Christmas Eve for the first time, and the thing that moved all of them was that each of them took turns reading Genesis in a broadcast back to Earth on Christmas Eve in 1968. That was phenomenal. And then when Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong landed on the moon for the first time, I don't know if Neil was still in the lander or if he had made his first step, but Buzz requested radio silence, and he was talking to Charlie Duke. Charlie Duke was the voice for Houston for Apollo 11. He requested radio silence so that he could have communion in the lunar lander, and one of the scriptures that he read was, or he read two, "I am the vine and you are the branches. Apart from me, you can do nothing." And he read from Psalm 8. Which I think is where kind of the gist of what we're talking about here, Justin, where David's saying, "When I consider thy heavens, the moon and the stars which thou hast ordained, what is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you care for him?" And I think when any of us look at the cosmos, we all intuitively know there is a story to be told about what is above us. Mm. And it's like that God created the universe so that we would ask this question. You can't stare at the heavens and not think about your place within them.
Mm.
And unfortunately, the narrative that has roared, I think, since Matthew Arnold, has been one of cosmic insignificance.
Yes.
That somehow, and you've heard this story a million times on Unbelievable, thanks to Copernicus and then Galileo and all the confirmational science since then, we've been dethroned from our central position in the universe. But thanks be to Lewis again. In his 16th century book, I read that his study, I mean, this was the Copernican time period, that the contemporaries of Copernicus, anybody living at the time, would not have told you that Earth was the throne of the cosmos. It was the sump.
Yes.
It was a dump. It was where all the stuff fell.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't, it was central, but we're not looking at this position, the centrality of ourselves, as a special place.
Yeah.
It's kind of like living in a landfill.
It's
glorious, but it's fallen. They had a very realistic understanding, and they all understood the Earth was a globe. There's no flat Earth in medieval theology or philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
But the modern narrative, again, here's that myth where Copernicus dethrones us, decentralizes us from the cosmos, and we lose our significance. Mm-hmm. But here's the myth, Justin. Science, you can't, and I know you know this, science, size or location doesn't determine your significance.
Absolutely.
So how is it that we are being told by science popularizers, and they seem to be getting away with it, this mythological idea that science has dethroned our specialness as human beings?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a kind of a contradiction as well, because at the same time that we're being told that science has dethroned our specialness, we're also being told, but isn't this universe amazing? You know, people,
I know, make
the,
up your
the
mind,
science
right?
And wonder, the awe and wonder of, you know, being alive in the universe and so on. It's like they kind of want us to believe you know, the whole thing's been explained away, but they still want the magic and the enchantment of, mm-hmm. of what it represents, because we mm-hmm. can't kind of live without that, I think. So I think it's everything you've said, I absolutely agree with. I think ultimately the heavens above us are telling the glory of God, and it's very difficult, I think, for someone to look for too long at that and to sort of retain a completely materialistic sense
right.
of reality.
Right.
I mean, it's funny, I was just, you know, here in Texas, and I went around the Johnson Space Center the other day.
Yes,
And, you know, you're reminded of just all the incredible, what it took to get people to the mm-hmm. moon and everything mm-hmm. else, and just some of the amazing stories there. And it reminded me that they quoted, of course, the Book of Genesis when they first went around the moon and so on. I think it was Christmas Eve, wasn't it?
Yeah, Christmas Eve, 1968. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, Madeleine Murray O'Hare.
Sued
NASA.
Sued them, yeah.
You know, was quoting scripture. This was, you know, a government-funded organization.
Right.
And I think
the courts ruled it out because there was no jurisdiction on the moon.
That's
that was
right.
Official.
Yes. That was a nice loophole. So, but that was just kind of, it made me think, though, you know, how sad, in a sense, that Madeleine Murray O'Hare, kind of, that was her concern. Because I can't think of a better, more beautiful thing.
So many
to
people
say.
Have said that are not religious.
Exactly.
What else
yes.
are you going
exactly.
to
exactly? What are you going to go with if you don't go?
You
with
don't even have to believe it, but if you don't understand or recognize when you see the earth from
yeah.
that distance,
yeah.
that
yeah.
what else are we going to talk about? In the yeah. beginning, God created the heavens and
it's,
the earth.
It's kind of, you know, if you'd replaced it with, I don't know, just a scientific explanation of what's happening, you know, hey, we happen to be, you know, circumnavigating
well, it was
the moon.
Better than Oppenheimer quoting the Bhagavad Gita.
Yeah, quite, exactly. So I just think, look, there's something timeless about the Bible, about the way in which it has, in a pre-scientific age, made sense of people's lives. And in a scientific age, it still somehow resonates. It's got this miraculous ability in whatever age we happen to live in to explain and help make sense of
yeah.
the universe people think they're living in.
Now, did you know that there is a connection between the Saturn? Did you see the Saturn V on its side?
Yes, we did. Yeah.
Okay, so that
yeah.
thing's massive, right?
Yeah, it's huge.
That was that was going to be Apollo 20, but we never made it past
yeah.
17. But that thing is huge.
Mm.
So as you're having this in mind, do you know that there's a connection between that rocket and The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe?
No, tell me.
Okay. So what's Lewis's opening line in Lion, the Witch, and Wardrobe?
Oh, no,
you don't have to do it verbatim, but just the general. How does this open?
I can't even remember. What is the opening line?
Okay, so this is a story
oh,
about
yes.
how four children
that's right.
were sent out to the country
yes.
because of the air raids.
That's right.
And Lewis is so brilliant because you're like, air raids?
Yeah.
What is he talking? What's
yeah.
the historical
yeah.
context of what he's doing?
Mm-hmm.
This is what upset Tolkien so much, because Lewis would just throw something in there and ignore it and not explain it. You know, and for readers that aren't familiar with Narnia, this is a hugely significant thing because, as you know, the history of Europe. What was Operation Pied Piper? Do you remember?
I don't.
Oh my gosh.
Tell me.
Okay,
tell me.
So
you're filling in the gaps in my ignorance here.
Operation Pied Piper was the moving a bunch of children out of London to the countryside because
yeah.
of the German bombings, the Luftwaffe, the air raids. Okay, so Lewis is talking about the air raids. This is the German attack on Europe. Well, one of those air raid bomb technology things that the Nazis had was the V2 rocket, where you could launch it from the ground into Europe. And Europe was not destroyed completely, but it was certainly
under attack
through the V2 rocket. Who designed the V2 rocket? A German rocket scientist by the name of Wernher von Braun. He nearly died in an Allied bombing raid on German scientists and labs during World War II, but he escaped, was captured, was given clemency in the United States in order to help the U.S. build the Saturn V.
Ah.
He's the chief engineer rocket engineer, the chief rocket scientist of the Saturn V, and became a Christian. He said he was a lukewarm Christian during his war years, but he, once the war was over, he recognized his need of Jesus and became a committed Christian, or rededicated his life, however you want to do it. But he was a Christian man. He was the principal rocket engineer for the Saturn V rocket.
How interesting.
And there it is, all in a sentence.
Yes.
In the Chronicles of Narnia. And how, well, see, I think, Justin, we need, as Lewis would say, we need more people thinking in an interdisciplinary way, how history, philosophy, and theology all kind of connect and can be told in a creative way. Another fun fact, I don't know if you know NBC News here in the United States. You guys have the BBC, but we have NBC, CBS, and whatever. NBC's been around for a while. Have you ever heard, I don't know if you've ever heard it, but next time you go online, look up NBC News, Nightly News' theme music. We're talking about stories and narratives. Guess who wrote, in 1985, wrote the theme music for NBC News?
Tell me.
John Williams.
Oh.
Steven Spielberg's right-hand man for all the musical scores of all the movies that we know, Indiana Jones, Star Wars, and anything else. But ask yourself, why did NBC contract an orchestra composer like John Williams to score a nightly news broadcast? What are we doing there? We're telling ourselves that this is a dramatic story.
That
we need John Williams soundtrack to orchestrate our lives.
Absolutely.
You know, does that not yield the idea that we are indeed storytellers?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I can agree more with you. And I think that storytelling aspect of us has never gone away. I mean, one of the points I make in my book is that, in a way, the Atheist Project kind of tried to create a kind of a non-story. It tried to create a kind of a story, but that basically took away the story. It tried to say, well, look, everything you think is actually just an illusion. Okay, there is no real beauty, justice.
Isn't that the green lady in Silver Chair?
Yes, she wants.
She's like, there's no upstairs, there's no sun, there's no moon.
Exactly.
Right.
And so their story of reality, of a universe that sort of potentially came from nowhere, is heading into oblivion, is just this purely deterministic thing that will just take the course it takes, and it doesn't really matter a blind bit of difference what you think.
Right.
Your trajectory was always determined from day one. It's this kind of story where it's really just indifferent, you know, and all the little stories we tell ourselves, they're just sort of illusions in the big scheme of things. They're fairy tales. And to that extent, I think that non-story, if you like, that they tried to sow, kind of has become the background hum for lots of people. It's sort of, but people can't make sense of their lives in that. That's why I think it contributed to this meaning crisis and everything else, because people need a story where they actually have agency in the story.
Yeah, and it talks to our, you're not going to get married in a garage.
Yes.
Part of your celebration of your marriage, it has an aesthetic quality, and you both have a story.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the wedding is kind of an unfolding of that story, but I love how your book emphasizes our need to retell that. And you have had so many wonderful stories, not only in your book of these intellectuals contemplating Christianity, but on your 17-year run with Unbelievable. The two people coming together telling different stories about their perspective of reality. I think we're hungry for that dignity, hungry for that place in the narrative. And I think it's Sam Gamgee that says to Frodo in Lord of the Rings, they discover the glass that Galadriel had given them, that they're carrying it. She has given it to them, and they're talking. They're involved in talking about being a part of those old tales, being a part of the greatest tales. And Sam Gamgee is stunned with this wonderful realization: we're in the tale.
We're in it. We're part of it.
We're in the tale. Yeah. Do the great tales ever end?
Yes. Well, you know, it's sometimes be said we're living in, you know, the final chapter of Acts. You know, that Acts is a book that tells the story of how that story of Jesus started to be told among all the nations, and it kind of ends sort of abruptly. It doesn't really have an ending, the book of Acts, does it? And I think that's kind of good, because it tells you, well, you're the next chapter. Actually, you're part of this bigger story. I find that exciting. I mean one of the biggest things for me that gives me hope is that we're in a story that isn't finished yet. And sometimes we look at our culture and we sort of bemoan the direction and the trajectory of the culture. And, you know, we think, gosh, what's happened, why is the Christian church, you know, in decline and everything else. But I always like to think, well, actually, we're kind of, maybe we're just at chapter 7 in a 21 chapter book, you know, and there's going to be ups and downs, and you know, the hero might just turn, you know, turn around and suddenly rescue the situation. I think God's right. in the business of surprising us, and we're going to look back on the big story and realize, hey.
Well, and I think the burden is, Justin, without God, we have to write our own stories, and we're not sure. How do you write your own story? How do you, you're not, I mean, the uncertainty that we're burdened with as a culture, what's going to happen tomorrow, we don't know. And we don't know how, I mean, I think that is so suffocating. And it's, I mean, this is what I think Jesus is getting at when he says, come to me, all you are weak and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. And we are an anxious, fear-ridden, driven, nonstop, 24/7 consumer. There's no rest for us.
Yeah.
Alan Noble, again, we're getting back to that. But I wanted to close with this and have your thoughts on the storytelling and how Jesus fits into this. Ephesians 2:10 says, "We are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand so that we would walk in them." So it seems that it's not just doing religious duties at church, but the narrative that God has been written for us. And it's like a banquet. It's like the wedding feast that he describes. I mean, in Psalm 19, you quoted, God compares the son to a bridegroom. And the whole story is the marriage of Jesus and his church. And he's a bridegroom rejoicing to run his course. And the son is there as a symbolism. And Lewis believed in the symbolic, spiritually symbolic nature of stars and planets. And he loved Psalm 19. So here's a spiritual symbolic symbol of the son as a bridegroom coming out of his chamber, rejoicing to run his course. That Jesus fulfills the things for us that we could not do for ourselves. And loves us with a love that is inexplicable. The people kind of love that. I'm starving for. I'm reading Alan Noble, going, "This is my spiritual biography."
Absolutely. You know? Yeah.
But this is a narrative that people, obviously, we know that they need, but we have to make it. How do we, Justin? How do we incorporate Christ in this narrative and reintroduce him to our culture in these narrative contexts? To make, we don't want to change the story, we don't want to water it down, but we do need to, I've heard you say it a couple times today, we do need to make it attractive.
Yeah.
How do we make it attractive without looking like the culture or...
I think that's the big challenge, and I think sometimes the church does make missteps here. I think it's interesting because in the course of speaking to a number of these secular intellectuals who are reminding people of the Christian story, I've often asked them, well, what would maybe attract you to actually set foot in church, to kind of investigate that story yourself? And one thing they've often said is, well, a church that just looks increasingly like the culture around it is would not make me want to, because they want, as Douglas Murray put it, he said, keep Christianity weird. He was like, Tom Holland has said to me several times, the UK historian, I don't want to kind of warmed over humanism with a bit of God sprinkled on top. That looks like Hollywood. You know, he wants something that's mysterious, deep, otherworldly.
Do you think that's why the intellectuals that you've mentioned, a lot of them are going to the Catholic Church?
I think it
Eastern
is.
Orthodox.
Yeah, I think that's a lot to do with it. Yeah.
Protestantism has lost its mind.
Well, when Tom Holland does go to church, he goes to the oldest church in the city of London, a very Anglo-Catholic, highly kind of aesthetically kind of charged, kind of symbolic service. He doesn't, and that's partly just his temperament, his character, but I think it's also because if this story is true, he wants to kind of be told it in a different way to the culture. He doesn't want
it must be beautiful, but it must be beautiful in a way that we fail to comprehend.
Exactly.
This was Lewis's complaint about some of the literature that he would look at. He'd say that it has no atmosphere. The Three Musketeers, they go from one city to the next. I'm paraphrasing, but he says they go from one city to the next. So what? You know, there's no description of trees and weather and tea and he says, as human beings, we want the aesthetic aspect of the story. So, as Michael taught me, part of his effort in Narnia was to make an aesthetically pleasing place to rest and to read and to be able to weep and to rejoice. And it has had that profound effect on people that read it because of that aesthetic element that he incorporates. And I think what Tom Holland's after, what we're all after, that weirdness factor, if you will, is a kind of longing for a beauty that this world just does not.
Yes.
The pause of, like, I was coming in today and saw the sun coming up out of the clouds, and I love nature, and it just reminds me of God all the time. And, you know, I get kind of emotional if I see the beauty of nature. And so many people are having these kind of aesthetic experiences. Mm. I think you outlined a couple of them where people are encountering something beautiful, something resonates. A child, you have a lady in the book looked on the beauty of her newborn child. Mm. This can't be just a pile of molecules. Yeah. So there's this, I think, part of what, however we decide to tell the story, it has to be aesthetically appealing in a way that people have yet to see.
Absolutely. And it's the reason we still turn up, even in our secular scientific age, for the superhero movies and the Harry Potter stories.
Yeah, that's
and
good
the,
point.
It's kind of, it engages our imagination. We're still, you know, we want life to be an adventure. We want life to be more than just, you know, what the atheist told us it was, after all. And so I think, yeah, I think actually lean into that, you know, as a church. Don't try and dumb it down, water it down, trying to kind of rationalize it all. Actually lean into the weirdness, in a sense that this is something different. This is something out of people's everyday. Mm. Now, it doesn't have to be the kind of high Anglo-Catholic thing, though that is going to appeal to some people. But the other part of the church that's growing, you know, in the UK, apart from the Anglo-Catholic side, is the kind of very Pentecostal side, the kind of the part of the side that just leans into the experiential, that kind of sense of actually there's a real world here that we can engage with. And I just think actually we need to engage that. We need to engage our imagination. In that sense, I think we need to tell the Christian story in ways that Lewis managed to do it, in ways that kind of captivate people's imagination, make them want it to be true.
Right.
Before showing them that it is true. And to that extent, it is going to be about the creativity of us in telling a story in a more compelling, beautiful way.
Mm-hmm.
I think we did that without really trying in ages past, you know, because we were sort of living within the story in a way that we don't live in it now. So it was just infused in Dante and in Michelangelo and in, you know, all those. The story bubbled up everywhere around us.
We don't have the cultural purveyors today. Yeah. Not to say that there aren't good artists, musicians, and painters and whatnot out there today, but the culture in which these great works of art have come. I'm not saying it's all entirely Christianity, but the idea of being what Tolkien called a sub-creator, his whole vision that we are created in the image of God, part of that means that we too take delight in creating. And there's not any one of us that isn't involved in some way of creating things, even if it's a secretary making a schedule.
Yeah.
We are creating things, and we try to do so as much as we can aesthetically. We try to adhere to making it at least palatable to the eyes, if you will.
Yeah.
So there's a way in which we need to capture it. And I think, I mean, according to what I understand in Scripture, it is told through the narrative, the proclamation of the gospel, the stories of Jesus. Was when he was asked a question, what did he do? He told a story.
Yeah, absolutely. You
know? Who's my neighbor? He doesn't point to that guy and just says that guy. He tells them a story.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, when I see Paul in Athens speaking to the philosophers and Epicureans and Stoics, he's doing something very different to just sort of shouting them down and telling them they're all wrong. He's offended by their idolatry, but the way he actually talks to them is as equals, saying, well, I see you're very religious.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of tries to find that common ground and say, you're looking for a story. I can see that. Well, let me tell you a story about a God, this unknown God, who is actually not that far from you. And you've been groping around, but this God actually has a name. He has this son, Jesus Christ, and let me tell you the story. And yes, some of them scoffed and mocked, but some of them believed. And so it shall be, I think, in our generation.
Well, now I know that there have been a ton of Christians listening to you over the years, Justin, and I'm sure our listeners are like, well, that's Justin Brierley, and he's sat in front of the most brilliant minds on the planet. I can't do that. I can't talk to these people. And we tend to, when we get up on stage, if you will, not stage, but if we put ourselves out there, a lot of us, myself included, even with all the knowledge that I claim to know, that we are so afraid of our own frailties and weaknesses, getting back to what Jordan Peterson, we're afraid because we are frail. We don't want to seem vulnerable. I think that's a lot of, I think, why we are hesitant, maybe because of our own sins and weaknesses. Yeah. But I think, to me, in my own experiences, the more vulnerable I've been in confessing what I don't know and my own weaknesses, I think that gives people hope. Justin, do you struggle with anything?
I struggle with an awful lot. And the thing is that I'm glad that God has given me a platform and an ability to have conversations with people. But there is so much I can't do, which other people can do, because I cannot paint. I can't play music, or not very well. I can't, you know, and there's so it really doesn't matter in a sense. You know, it's not that the thing I do is the thing that everyone needs to be doing. It's that everyone needs to be playing to their strength where they are,
right,
in telling that story. And that's going to look very different for different people. But it's like, it's people are desperate for that authenticity, to kind of hear a story that is good, beautiful, and true.
Well, my wonderful Texas neighbor that I've known for quite some time had said, "Dan, you just got to know what you're dumb at."
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it.
And that's the Texans' way of saying be aware of your weakness, because that's where, despite your weakness, I'm going to Utah next week and I'm scared to death. God still uses me in my weakness, and I think that we should encourage people, hey, don't worry about that, because the people that you're going to go reach also have weaknesses and
be
sin.
be yourself. And just like people, I think actually are a lot more moved than you may realize by you just being honest and transparent about who you are, your struggles, the fact that you haven't made sense of it all, but there's something about this Jesus story that does resonate with you.
Right.
And don't worry if they mock or laugh. It's at the end of the day, you know, the story, it'll be around for a long time to come.
Awesome. Excellent book. I just finished reading it yesterday, The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God. Why New Atheism Grew Old, and Secular Thinkers Are Considering Christianity Again. Final thoughts, Justin?
Thank you so much for having me on, Daniel. And I would just encourage, if you feel a bit beat down, kind of disillusioned, jaded at the state of culture and the church, this is maybe just a little moment of optimism to say, God's not finished. The story isn't over. There's lots of things happening, and who knows what the next surprising turn, twist in the plot might be. I hope that I might be onto something, that there is something going on in our culture. People are maybe ready to hear that story again.